Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Lisa Archibald, co-director of Intentional Peer Support, to talk about the importance of peer support within mental health and the role it can play in helping to build stronger, connected, and healthier communities. Lisa describes herself as a proud Scot and has set up, coordinated, and trained peer communities internationally for 20 years. She became an intentional peer support trainer in 2016, facilitating training and co-reflections for the IPS Hub in New Zealand, Australia, and then IPS Central. Lisa was a Winston Churchill Fellow in 2013, a Yale Let's Lead Fellow in 2019, and is currently doing her final year in MAD studies at Queen Margaret University, Scotland. Welcome to the show, Lisa. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I wish you guys could have been part of our not recorded conversation. And I'm just trying to tap in and make the most of Lisa's wealth of knowledge and experience in peer support. And one of the things, you know, we talked about was, you know, the different, I guess, the professionalization of treatment in mental health. I'm a clinical psychologist. And, you know, I really was drawn to peer support primarily because in Malaysia, we don't have a lot of resources. And we always lament the lack of resources, and you're in the NHS and you know how under-resourced the NHS is as well. But so instead of lamenting, we should look beyond our traditional solutions to look at who else has something to offer, who else can help our communities be healthier. And one of it was peer support. Now, peer support, I'm not sure people know a lot about it. And so I was wondering whether you could just give us a brief explanation of peer support and how you became involved in it.
Yeah, so how I became involved in peer support was actually as a young person. And I was accessing peer support initially through the university that I was at because I was just really struggling with life. To be honest, everything in life felt really difficult. And I had, first of all, done the thing that many people had suggested you do, is go and see a doctor. And the suggestions and the solutions were just not making sense to me. I was ironically studying psychology at the time. And there was so much language, I know, there was so much language about the kind of brain chemistry. And it was all about dopamine and serotonin. I was just, this makes no sense to me. Nobody at any point had asked me about what had happened in my life. Nobody asked me my story. And so this moment where I went to a peer support group and we just started to connect through common stories of maybe difficult upbringings or difficult experiences or things that had happened in our life. And there was no fixing. That's what really stood out for me. It wasn't about fixing it. It was about just, I could just be myself and talk openly and honestly, and I felt heard. I just felt like people understood. And I didn't get that with any other type of help that I had accessed. And so as I worked through, I got my piece of paper, my degree, and then I just walked straight into peer support. And I started to facilitate peer support groups. I eventually started to do management, funding, setting up, establishing peer support groups, because for me, it was that beautiful thing of creating spaces where other people could have what I had in that moment where I was really struggling. And those connections between people were so important. It was just different conversations, like finding your tribe. My journey with peer support was that it's a way of being with someone. It's a thing that happens between people, whereas now it has become almost like a job title. And so people are forgetting the doing and the being part of peer support, and just, oh, I am a peer support worker. And so I think that's where it's become a little bit like mission drift,
right?
In a way.
It reminds me actually a lot about sort of Carl Rogers and how to just be with people. And he wasn't very, not about fixing people. Of course, he was a clinician, so he didn't want to get people better. But he was really trying to just see the person and to listen very carefully to their story. And then over time, partly due to, I think, many factors about insurance, you know, time-limited treatment, we need very clear KPIs. And are we meeting those targets? What are outcome measures? Let's be more cost-effective. All great things for a health system. But a person is lost in that system. You know, a person can lose their humanity. And then eventually they do just become a number on paper for someone to evaluate whether the system is working properly. So, you know, I think, you know, we've in clinical psychology, we've kind of gone in a direction that people are actually trying to pull back from. People are actually recognizing and saying, wait. we're supposed to be talking to people. You know, we want them to get better. We do offer treatment, but it's about the person. And it sounds like peer support, that walking into or almost like stumbling into peer support really was very life-changing for you. Now you're in it completely.
Yes, I don't know how to do anything else now. But I wouldn't want to either. And I think, and maybe it helped doing a clinical degree in terms of really questioning some of that wisdom that came in that space, that traditional wisdom. And then having this experiential wisdom in this other space and just realizing which one I felt was more valuable to me. You know, I had the opportunity to experience both. I think they're different. I'm certainly not anti-psychiatry. I'm anti-bad psychiatry. But, you know, I actually want to think about even some of the language or the terminology often we hear in medical services or even peer support that sits within medical services. A lot of talk about recovery, and recovery is so important, but recovery from what? I think often the missing question is, what are you recovering from? And sometimes people are recovering from injustice, poverty, abuse, systemic harm, not an illness. And I think sometimes in the mental health system as we have it, people presume someone's recovering from an illness. So the focus is on the illness, the symptoms, that conversation, rather than all the other parts of someone's life, people are often recovering from damaging relationships. And so if we don't support them to have meaningful relationships, and peer support's one way of doing that, how can you heal?
Let me see if I get that right, because I think that's pretty new to me as well. It's really recognizing that the person that walked in through our doors didn't just become this version of the person magically, that there were different contributing factors. As you said, you may be really difficult, toxic relationships. I know I use the word toxic. I don't really like that word so much, but you know, or as you said, injustice, a systemic injustice, racism, prejudice, and all these things really impact a person's health, actually even physical health. And it's not, it's not just that this person became depressed, woke up one day and says, I don't feel well anymore, right? And so we could target the symptom of depression, which is your low mood. And we could say, here, take this medication. Then you start feeling better, but not recognize that there were so many contributing factors.
And I think it moves us away from individualistic spaces where it's about there's something wrong with you or you need to change, and where peer support can really be about wider social change, because we're looking way beyond just an individual problem. We're actually saying something needs to change in our society, in our systems, in our services, in our communities, because it's causing harm to people. And I think that there's something in that shift that's so important for how we actually, I mean, if the medication was the answer, then we would have solved the problem of mental health by now. But we haven't. If anything, it's worse than ever. There's more people are struggling. So the solution is not individual medication. It's the solution is bigger than that. We need to change some things within our society, our culture, our communities, so that we can understand people's lives better.
That makes a lot of sense to me. But one of the things that you started out with is that we're not here to fix you. And, you know, people who come to see us, they say that they want to be fixed, right? They're also symptom focused. Whether it's well, I have panic attacks. I don't want to have panic attacks anymore. And, you know, when you say I don't want to fix people, can I just clarify? You're saying that you don't mind, you know, for lack of a better word now, I'm a bit cautious. Is it like, you don't mind the panic attacks continuing? Or are you saying like, you know, we couldn't create a community, you know, keep this thing that is impairing your life? You know, so you're coming from I'm just being bluntly ignorant. And I feel like you might be saying, oh my gosh, who is this person? But yeah. So could you help me just understand that bit?
Like, for example, with panic attacks, if we are looking at that as the panic attacks are the problem, we start talking about the panic attacks and we focus only on that instead of actually thinking, what is creating the panic? What are you scared of? What are you worried about? Let's understand what's happened in your life. And maybe if we understand what you're scared of, we can find ways to get through it and feel more relational. And maybe then the panic attacks will stop. But that's not the focus. The focus is understanding what's creating the panic. And sometimes as a metaphor, you know, some of how our body reacts is like trying to tell us a message about something. And if we don't listen, it's like an angry toddler that just shouts louder.
Oh, I like that. So it's not that you want someone to continue suffering with the panic attacks or continue to bear the consequences and experiences of panic attacks. It's more like saying it's not just about the symptom relief. And there's actually more ways for you to live your life and then how you're conceptualizing. Now I'm seeing like, okay, so yeah, we could go the psychiatry route, we could do medicine. But there's also something you said that I thought was quite profound beneath it. It was almost like understanding what my experiences are. You know, what is this telling me rather than seeing this emotion or this even depression as bad? You know, and yeah, that's something I had, you know, like for a long while, after depression, then every time I got sad, I was like, no. Oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to be depressed. And these low moods just became very scary to me with the fear of like, what if it overwhelms and sinks me down? Until I think I saw it more of like, okay, it's just reflecting that something is happening and I'll get through it. You know, it doesn't have to mean that dark period of my life. It doesn't have to keep repeating itself because, yeah, nobody wants to have to go through that bit. But, you know, I think being almost like being friendlier with the darkness within, which is what I call my depression.
Yeah, because we're conditioned to come from a place of fear with some of this. The system creates it, society creates it, is that we're told some feelings are bad and we have to shut them down. Even as children, don't be sad, don't be scared. And so we think that these feelings are wrong and bad and we try and shut them down instead of actually it's a feeling and it will pass. And sometimes thinking about what brought up that feeling can be important. I think with certain experiences that become packaged as diagnoses, they're often, we're so fearful that there's something wrong with feeling like that, that we can even perpetuate it ourselves, I think, with this is bad, this is wrong, I need to stop it, instead of actually understanding, you know, what is it that creates this feeling within me? Where does it come from? You know, why is it there? And with me, I stopped using the part disorder and I started to think I have obsessions and compulsions. And it's part of who I am. And I know that that's part of how I see the world. And I try and give myself permission to feel like that, because I'm like, oh, this is because I don't feel like I'm in control today, or the world feels a bit scary, and it'll pass. And it does.
It doesn't take over your life, you know. It doesn't, like, and you can still. I found like I was during depression really afraid that I would never be happy again. And I was like, I kind of even forgot that I had a happy side. And I was like, was I even ever happy? And you know, so it's almost like now you see that oh yeah, there's a part of me that can be quite depressive, but it doesn't have to be the overwhelming part of me, you know? And there's a part of me that thinks a lot about life. And when you think too much about life, it's actually quite depressing. But, you know, that the it's remembering too that then they're actually, I have to also, I think that's a right response actually to the difficult things of life is to feel sad, but to also remember that there are other aspects of me that need to be fed. There are other aspects of life that need to be experienced, not just how dark the world is.
Yeah, so the medical and the clinical perspective can be quite limiting because in that space, we're talking about symptoms, diagnosis, medication, all the things that are not working in our life becomes this. This is what's not working and it kind of dominates our worldview.
Can you give us an example? Because I don't think any of us know what actually happens. You know, what's a peer support system?
Yeah, what I value about peer support is actually it's a space where we can think about things in a different way. So like, for example, some of the, I used to run hearing voices groups. So for people who would hear voices, and within a clinical space, a lot of the education around this is that, you know, you don't talk about people's voices, you don't engage with that. It's not something that's kind of for discussion, but within peer support, it was actually such a helpful group space where we could explore, like, you know, what does this mean for you? When does it come about, you know, what's the message, what's the metaphor within this? And people would then share experiences of other times where they had maybe felt scared because they were having an experience they didn't understand. And even if you haven't had the same experience, you can still connect to the whole feeling of being out of control or feeling like you don't understand what's going on. And it's that validation of sometimes things are scary and you don't understand what's happening can feel like a really safe space to have conversations that are more brave. Whereas I think when in clinical spaces, if the expectation is that this is something that's bad and scary and shouldn't happen, you don't feel as open to be able to talk about it. You kind of feel fearful of it yourself.
I should is have even, sorry, go ahead.
Even with like quite extreme states, I suppose, or when people are in quite significant distress, I've seen peer support being one of the most effective ways of working through something.
And I mean, that sounds amazing. And you know, I don't think many of us are familiar with what an IPS group meeting would look like. I mean, I think we can think about AA. But so yeah. How does it, you know, how does it start? Do you identify yourself? Like, or is it just like people just kind of pop in and is there a structure to it? And could, you know, so could you just kind of give us an idea of what it actually looks like?
I suppose there's a couple of different ways of doing it. Sometimes people will have a group that meets for a certain amount of time. So they might meet for, you know, once a week for 10 weeks together and each week look at a particular topic or area of discussion. Other times it's a group that never ends and new people will come and people will go and it just is quite fluid. And there's challenges and benefits to both. But in terms of the structure, you know, it's a relational space. So people do identify who they are and talk about their lives. So it's probably different than some other spaces in that way. And the idea is that people bring what they need to bring in that time and work it out together. There's no, it's hopefully not hierarchical. It feels more shared. And so even as a facilitator, you're just holding the space rather than forcing the discussion. And so often we focus on the four tasks of intentional peer support, which is, you know, starting with just a connection, like what's something that's that people have felt connected to, either in their relationships or in life. You know, we can feel connected to animals, to nature, to spirituality. And so encourage people to think about what's meaningful in their connections in life first, and really coming from a place of curiosity. That's the worldview stuff. It's like trying to understand how each of us have come to see the world. And we don't always see it the same. And so if we have a different identity or experience, we might see the world through a different lens. And so I really appreciate the curiosity that can come from peer support spaces. And the unique part for me is that mutuality, that as a facilitator, it's not just me facilitating, I'm also sharing and I'm also bringing something. And so it feels two-way. It doesn't feel like a meeting that's led by a clinician or an expert. It's actually something we're just working out life together. And this final thing of moving towards kind of is like the magical thing that happens when all the other tasks are in place. We just naturally start moving towards something rather than moving away from. And I think so many times I've felt stuck in the clinical space around thinking, what's not working? What's wrong? What am I moving away from? What don't I want? Rather than actually thinking, you know, what could my life be like, or what might be different, or what's possible? And it's such a small shift, but a meaningful shift that happens in peer support spaces.
I like, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about this conversation is I feel like I'm learning how to become a better clinician already, just, you know, because you're right, you know, we come with, especially if we have a treatment focus and we want to be efficient and, but that, particularly the last bit, you know, what are you moving towards? And I think what happens, you know, is that you stop thinking of a life of potential, right? You're kind of just looking now, it's like, okay, got to fix this problem, you know, which whatever problem that you're facing. And you it's hard to almost see beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a conversation with someone saying, you know, could you imagine yourself even 10 years? And I think especially the longer you've been, I know if you don't use the word disorder, could I say ill?
Yeah, you can say whatever word you want. It's okay.
I'm being so cautious with my language.
They're only words. It's
yeah,
fine.
They're only words. Okay. okay. So, you know, the longer I was depressed for, or, you know, the harder it was to imagine a life outside of that. And I think, you know, just a question of, you know, what do you want to move towards? Take, as you're right, it is a shift. It's quite subtle, but it's so important. You know, start getting someone to imagine something. It's a life of possibilities and of potential.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reason we call this a relational approach. It's not just something that peer support workers can benefit from. Actually, I use some of this in my real life, like with my family, with my children, with friends. You know, if someone comes and there's maybe a relational dynamic we keep getting stuck in, you know, maybe they're always asking for my help. And so I jump into this response where I become the helper or the fixer. As I might want to be brave about some of those conversations and say, hey, you know, I know this is kind of where we've got to and I'd like things to be different. You know, how might our relationship look different if instead of me always helping and you asking for help, could we try something a bit different? So things that I've learned in a peer support space, I then will try and implement in my life relationships in another space, just because I felt more confident with having those conversations rather than just getting stuck, which has been harder in my personal life than anywhere else.
Right. So really practical, useful skills. And we know, actually, I mean, the relational approach, I think one of the closest therapies that come to what you're describing is the interpersonal psychotherapy approach.
Mm-hmm.
It really talks about, you know, that your feelings are reasonable. Often they tell you what's going on in a situation and how to use your feelings to meet your needs, you know, and often it is about asserting self and saying, you know, I don't like it if you do this. And I felt sad when that happened. And so that seemed quite, I think, complementary and less actually. IPT is as an approach is less goal oriented than some of the more structured therapies.
Yeah, and I think that the interpersonal is what's important, because we often can see mental health struggles from such an individualistic perspective that when we focus on the interpersonal, it's actually something's happened between people. And so it's not just you that's broken because you react in a certain way, but actually we're not just little robots navigating the world all the time. There's things that will activate something in us through a conversation or our experience or something that makes us feel scared or unsafe. And I think that interpersonal part is so missed in the mental health system because we're not actually talking about our relationships enough.
Right. So talking about relationships and I want to, I wish I could actually talk more to you about this, but I know we need to wrap up. It's where does peer support fit into the mental health care system, right? Because, you know, you talk about the clinical space, or like we talked about psychiatrists. And you actually mentioned that you're not anti-psychiatry.
No.
So where would you see peer support fitting in, and where does it sit?
I mean, I think it complements what's there, because I look at the gaps in the existing system or parts of the system that I just see as not working. You know, we talked earlier about how under-resourced the system is, which implies to me that we need to look at this differently, right? It's like, okay, well, if there's only so many resources and what we can offer with that is not enough for what people need, then we need to think more creatively. And so I've always appreciated being part of peer support communities that sit alongside the system, so that if the system is causing someone harm, that there's a space that people can meet and talk about that as well. Or if the system's under-resourced and they can't spend as much time with someone as they need to work through what's happening in their lives, that there could be peer support groups or peer support one-to-one opportunities for people to have more time to work on these conversations. I've always thought that peer support works best when it's autonomous and independent of the system, but also working alongside, so that if somebody who's maybe a clinician is meeting someone they think will benefit peer support, they know where that group is or how they refer them or link them up. And so I think there's relationships that can happen between the existing system and services and peer support communities that could be reciprocal, because there will be sometimes people will want a clinical or a medical approach. And that's complete. That's one of my difficulties, is when people don't have a choice and they feel like they have to go a particular route. So I'd like to see more options for people around what supports are available. And I think peer support offers another option that can be really beneficial.
Yeah. So yeah, I agree with that, because it could be, I mean, for like medication could be really helpful for that person. Yeah. But if you mm-hmm. force that person, then it actually becomes less helpful. Same with psychotherapy. You know, one of the sort of fundamental human needs is for that need for autonomy, to make some choices, to not feel like mm-hmm. a robot. And, you know, especially in an Asian society, forcing people mm-hmm. to do what's good for them actually becomes bad for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I think that people go into it for the wrong reasons then. You know, one of the places I've seen peer support work really well is when people are working out what they do need and want. And I suppose that's that moving towards part too, is, you know, if they're thinking about medications, actually spending some time with other people who have had that experience, and some people who have, you know, been on different medications, and just in a peer support space, just being explorative. Like, it's not about, actually it becomes conversations that aren't even about the medication. It's just about like, well, what are you hoping for? What do you think that it might bring to your life? You know, how are you thinking things might be different? Which is much more about the person and their life. Clinicians don't have the time to explore in that depth with people before they give them the prescription.
Yeah, we probably tell people, here are your treatment options, go think about it, come back and tell us what you want, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As you know, so just a final bit is, you know, is there something that you want us as a, so I know this is not a bad question, let me change that, sorry. So I'm going to try it again. Because you wouldn't know. As a final sort of question, is this something that you wish you had known starting out this peer support journey? Because, you know, we talked about how Relate Malaysia wants to bring IPS in and we want to implement it here and to give people, at least offer people that option of receiving IPS. They don't even need to, you know, go through a clinical interview. They don't need to do any of those, you know, sort of professional services. They can just access that. You know, was something that you wish that you had known as you had started that journey?
I have had so many learnings. I mean, if I'm honest, when I first started in peer support, I was doing bad peer support for quite a long time because I was replicating the system. Like, I thought I had to be the expert knower. I thought I had to have all the answers. And so I really wasn't doing peer support. I thought I had to have all the right responses. You know, I would go on all these different trainings that would, when somebody was having quite a significant experience of distress, it would be like, okay, well, I need a plan, I need to take them to hospital, I need to, you know, it was just like tick boxes. And I don't think I was really prepared at that time to give enough of myself. And actually, when I did go into thinking about things more intentionally, it really shifted things. A weight lifted off my shoulders, and I realized I didn't need to have the answers. I didn't need to get it right all the time. I could just focus on actually connecting with someone and thinking about, like, how do we struggle together sometimes. I didn't jump into having the answers, and that was quite freeing. I think it made me a better peer supporter because I felt more confident saying, look, I don't know what to say right now, but, you know, why don't we just sit and work it out together, and realizing sometimes that's the right thing to say and in an authentic peer support conversation, rather than feeling like I had to be an expert and have the right answer. Is sometimes there are no answers. We just are struggling with something. And I wish I had known that for a long time. I really was exhausted doing this work, and it probably wasn't that helpful to other people. And so I just wanted to create spaces where we could just work it out together and explore and be curious, rather than trying to replicate a system which was fixing and making better all the time. Like, sometimes things don't get better if you're living in poverty or you're living in an unsuitable housing. Like, it's not something we can find a quick fix for. Sometimes we have to say, you know, that's hard, and you know, I'm sorry that you're experiencing this, but, you know, let's at least talk about it. So yeah, I wish I knew that I could just not have the answers. That was helpful.
I think, you know, we all need to kind of learn that, right? And I think that's really a great way to end our conversation, because a lot of people listening in often have that question, how do I support a friend, right? How do I support a relative? And just, it's almost like tolerating our own distress of not knowing, you know? People want a script. And if we could just say, it's okay not to know. I know that's going to make me angry, but if it's okay not to know, and then for us not to, you know, that as that person looks to you for all the answers, that you're okay with not knowing.
Yeah. Yeah. And tolerating really your own discomfort.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And just saying, I'm going to have to sit with my discomfort on this, because, or I don't need to assume that my answer is the answer. There is no one truth or answer. It's the person's answer that's important. And so sometimes just being uncomfortable while they work it out, which might take longer than we want it to.
Yeah. And just, you know, I think really that focus being, I want to know you, and I'm here to listen, and I may not have the answers, and you might be frustrated at that. But this is what I can offer, right? This is what I'm willing to offer. I'm willing to kind of sit with you with that. And I think that's where also, you know, that principle of mutuality comes in, because it's disappointing that I don't have all the answers.
Yeah. And sometimes that can be a helpful starting point in peer support. It's like, what are you looking for and what are you hoping for from this relationship? Because sometimes we don't ask that enough.
That's great. So thank you so much, Lisa, for sharing with us what IPS is. And I think it's you know, so much to offer our community. There's so much for our community to learn from that, but also just on a personal in a personal relationships, how can we support the people around us?
Thank you. Yeah.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Being Human. We'll be hosting guests on a regular basis, so be sure to tune in for some more insights on how we can understand ourselves better and learn to live a life on our own terms and one that's meaningful to us. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and I look forward to sharing some more valuable insights from the world of mental health with you very soon.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.